Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and Eastern family. We're happy you're listening to the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. My name is Neil Holland, producer of the show. We normally have at the 3 p.m. time slot from the Eastern Files, which is usually about a half-hour show, from stories and memories of those that have sent in and written in stories that they want to be shared with the Eastern family. But this afternoon, we've got something special. A show that we did this past Monday evening at 7 p.m. With three very experienced, very knowledgeable folks in aviation accidents and investigation. And we thought it would be good to take a portion of that show and air it during this time slot. So we hope you enjoy it. And tell your friends that they can listen to it anytime by going to www.ealradioshow.com. And the entire episode is known as episode 307. So let's get that portion that we have pre-recorded underway. Thanks for listening.
Hello, folks. Well, we've got a great show for you tonight. Our special guests on tonight's show are two authors of highly acclaimed books on air safety. Actually, I should say three. One you know is a host on our Monday shows, George Jen, but we'll talk about him in just a minute. But first of all, let's introduce Carlene Petit. She's an international airline pilot who is type-rated, has flown and or has instructed on the Boeing 747-400, 747-200, 767, 757, Boeing 737, 727, and the A330 aircraft. Carlene is a 38-year veteran of flying and has worked for Coastal Airways, Evergreen, Premier, Braniff, America West, Yana, Tower Air, Northwest Airlines, and she's currently based in Los Angeles on the Boeing 777, awaiting training. Carlene lives in Seattle, and she's the mother of three, grandmother of eight, and holds an MBA degree, and is working on her PhD degree in aviation with safety as her focus. It's great to have you with us, Carlene. And golly, I don't know how in the world you got an extra second there.
Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, just listening to you makes me kind of tired, but you know, when you span it over a lifetime, it's very doable.
Great. Well, you've accomplished so many things and some great work in your book, so we're happy to have you with us tonight. Dorothy, how about introducing Christine?
Christine Negroni is an American aviation and travel writer whose work appears in the New York Times, Seattle Post-Intelligencer, Air and Space, Fortune Magazine, Airways, Runway Girl Network, and other publications. She is the author of two books, Deadly Departure in 2000 and The Crash Detectives Investigating the World's Most Mysterious Air Disasters in 2016. September 27th of 16, actually. It was published by Penguin Books. Christine is an on-camera contributor for ABC News and writes two blogs, the aviation-themed Flying Lessons and the travel blog Go How, Know How. She is married to Jim Shabari, an editor of the New York Times. They have four children.
Okay, let's talk about George Jenn for a minute. George Jenn was an Eastern pilot for 18 years and flew the Boeing 727, 737, and the Airbus A300. He was also a member of the board of directors and Eastern Master Executive Council Airline Pilots Association for 6 years. That's ALPA, A-L-P-A. He's a member of Eastern Airlines System Board of Adjustment, 10 years founder of Range Magazine, pilot, member of Eastern Airlines Employee Involvement Committee, and other ALPA committees. George had his first novel published in December of 2012, entitled Flying Too Close to the Sun. The second notification book, entitled Final Destination, Disaster, What Really Happened to Eastern Airlines, was published on October 1st, 2014. George also worked as an aviation expert witness in several federal lawsuits, including the world's largest Kendler and Kendler. Just as a reminder for everybody listening, I've read George's books, and they are fantastic. And if you haven't read them, you really need to do that. Chuck.
Now let's find out what each of our guests are doing or undertaking at the present. Carlene, you can start with us, and please tell us about your book, both published, or about what could be looking in the future.
Well, you know, what I'm doing is I'm writing a series of aviation thrillers that read like mysteries, and everyone, we just spent 2 days out of a Northwest Aviation Conference, and everyone says, is this fact or, you know, is this fiction or is this real? And what I'm doing is I wanted to create awareness of what's going on within our industry from behind the scenes and things that I think that we need to change. And it's like, how do you change, you know, something that's so global and it's so, you know, I shouldn't even say regulator. We're dealing with major airlines, government, and we don't have a lot of power to do that. So I thought I'm going to create awareness. So I've taken all these industry issues and woven them into these thrillers. And then in the process, I decided I was going to go back to school and get my PhD in aviation safety. And so during that, I'm starting to learn about safety culture and safety management systems. And SMS is going to be mandated in 2018. And there are many people out there who don't even know what that is, you know, so we're not there yet. So I've taken that and worked it in. And sadly, I should say interesting and sad, a lot of what I'm finding out and working into these novels is really true. And, you know, I started out coming out with what would happen if, and I would write a book on, I would say it would be more proactive safety, seeing something that could happen. And sure enough, in my first book on basically on mental health, how could you break a system before you broke the flight crews? And then 4 or 5 years later, we have, unfortunately, have German Wings, a pilot flying into a mountain. And then I have the next novel is on the A330 and training methodologies and how this training is getting cut short because it's just the opposite. The more complex the aircraft are, they cut the training back, but in reality, we actually need more training because we need to understand when the stuff breaks how to fly an airplane. And sure enough, that novel was with the editor, and Aviana crashes short in San Francisco just because something became disengaged. You know, so that's what I'm doing with the work. And the scary truth is, the more I dig into it, I'm really finding out what is going on behind that curtain within our industry. And we have a lot of work to do, a lot of work. And I also wrote a motivation book, Flight to Success, Be the Captain of Your Life, because I love this business. I love aviation. I love flying. I've had such a blessed career, and I want to share that with these new, you know, new kids coming into it. So half of me wants to, I want to leave it better. So I've inspired them, and I want to leave it better than I found it. And I want to be their advocate. Every new pilot out there that's coming into this, a little fearful, am I going to have a job? Are they going to automate me out of my job? Are we going to put cameras in there? Are they going to cut half my pay? What is this going to look like in 10, 15, 20 years? Well, I am educating myself and building the credentials that I will be an outspoken advocate for that career to keep it going strong, kind of like you guys are doing, keeping Eastern Airlines alive. You know, this is what we need to do. We can't just retire, pack our bags, and leave. And so I've kind of decided that I'm committed the rest of my career and then beyond that to helping this industry from safety and from motivation and to grow it and keep it safer. So that's really what I'm doing with the books. My most recent novel is Flight for Sanity. If anyone wants to read them, Flight for Control is the first one. Basically, human factors, mental health. Flight for Safety, we go into what's happening within the training environment. Flight Survival, now we go further into next gen and drone operations and start touching on safety culture and SMS. And then Flight for Sanity is probably the scariest out of all of them because, I used to say that just the murder, the sex, and the sinister plot were fiction. Well, now the sinister plot no longer is fiction. So just the murder and the sex are the fiction parts of my novels, and which is kind of sad, but they're fun. And the most recent one, the comments are coming in. It's only been out for about 2 weeks, and people are reading it, and everybody's saying it's the best. So it's very good news. Like to hear that. So.
Yes, great.
Carlene? I'm going to jump in here. I just started it, and I tell you what, it grabbed me. I couldn't put it down. I'm about a third of the way through, but I'm a slow reader. But golly, Pete, I can just, visualize the scenery that you've created here and the people that you have started out with, and it's going to be a fun read. It really is. And all of it is, I'm sure, is 100% accurate, with the exception of what you just mentioned, that is fiction. So, but it's going to be a good read. I want you now to, before we introduce Christine, and Christine has some books out too, but I'd like for you to tell us, and so our listeners can jot down your URL or your web address or however they can order your books, and before... and we'll do it at the end of the show as well. But right now, just tell us, how can one go about getting your series of books?
Who are you talking to me, Carlene?
Yes, Carlene.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking to Christina. Oh, they're all on Amazon. We've got paper, hardback, and Kindle. And if you want an autographed copy, you can go to my blog and order them there. And it's CarlenePettit.com. So, and I'm all over social media. I'm LinkedIn Carlene Pettit. I'm Twitter Carlene Pettit. So I just utilize my name on everything. So you should be able to find me. But, go to my blog. I'll send you an autographed copy. And don't tell Amazon, but I undercut them by about $5. So it'll be our secret. it's the pilot price. We have to give that pilot special, right?
There you go. All right. Okay. Chuck,
you mentioned it. Christine, what works do you have underway? And please give us a list of your published works or about to be published.
Well, I can't even compare with Carlene with her 7 books and a motivational book and her 8 grandchildren. She's just so busy. She's busy, busy. And I thought I was busy, but she makes me look like I'm doing nothing. I'm standing still. But I do have a book out called The Crash Detectives, and it's a nonfiction book about aviation mysteries. It deals with Malaysia 370. And it compares that disappearance to the disappearance of the Hawaii Clipper back in 1938, and shows how when you look back in history, sometimes things have an awfully remarkable similarity to the present. So my book is about those 2 disappearances and other mysteries in aviation, and it ends with the mystery of human resiliency. Why humans are so important in aviation. You know, what we bring to the table, in spite of the fact that we're so fallible, you know, what we can rely on the human to do that the machine and the computer cannot do. So it's a nonfiction book. I hope it reads like fiction, but it's all true. And that's my most recent book, which is going to, it's been published in the United States since September. I'm leaving to London next week because it will be published in the UK for the first time, and then it will be published in Portuguese and Brazil this summer. So it's, you know, it's sort of hopefully taking off around the world. That's my goal.
Excellent.
Your husband now with the New York Times is. Does that allow you to keep your works right up there in the New York Times? And
I wish. You know, I was not reviewed by the New York Times. The Wall Street Journal gave me an unbelievably beautiful, fantastic review, and I threatened to marry the man who wrote it, but then he pointed out to my attention that both he and I were married, so I couldn't. But my husband does work for the New York Times, and I write for the New York Times, but it didn't seem to have, you know, any effect. And for that, I blame Donald Trump, because he basically was dominating the headlines at the time, and still is, of course, but was dominating the headlines when my book came out. And as they say, took all the oxygen out of the room. So I didn't get reviewed in the New York Times, but in spite of that, I have gotten a lot of good reviews, and the book is doing well. I think we're going into a second printing, and it's sold out within the first 3 weeks in Australia and New Zealand. I'm hoping it does the same thing in England. So we'll see. Tell all your friends. Buy multiple copies.
Now, how can they go about getting your book? It's the same thing.
Well, my book, like Carlene's books, are all on Amazon. They're at Indiegogo, which is another website for independent bookstores, BarnesandNoble.com. I mean, you know, any place you want to buy a book, you can go to your local bookstore.
Okay, well, I guess George, you're up to bat here. It's about the same question, so to speak. How about your published works and things that are about to be published? Let our people out there in radio land know what's going on with you.
Okay, well, as you know, my memoir, Final Destination Disaster, What Really Happened to Eastern Airlines, was published a little over 2 years ago. And like Carlene and Christine's book, it's doing very well. It is a memoir. As you know, as our listeners know, I was involved in a lot of different episodes leading up to the sale and the subsequent destruction of Eastern Airlines by the Texas Air Corporation. And that's pretty much chronicled in the book, and where it led me was somewhere I never dreamed it would, but it ultimately led me down to South America. And my first book, the novel, Flying Too Close to the Sun, actually had a problem with my publisher on that book. He owed me some money, and I guess he was experiencing some financial problems. And so I told him that I'd like to get the rights of the book reverted back to me in exchange for what he owed me, and he did that. So I now have a literary agent who is out there attempting to sell the book to the larger publishing house. I have a couple of other books. One is finished. Neil knows about that one. I forwarded him chapter one of it and the introduction. It's more of a comedy book, and I've just been holding off on publishing that. But I don't know. It's pretty tough to keep up with Carlene and Christine, who I've read Christine's book. I have not read Carlene's books, any of them yet, but I will. And I can tell you that Christine's book, her latest book, The Crash Detectives, I couldn't put it down. It was excellent. And I wrote a critique of it on Barnes & Noble, of course, on their website, and gave it the highest rating that I could, and because it deserved it. And that's about it for me.
Thank you,
George.
Thank
you very much. We can open it up to some discussion now. Neil, you had something you want to talk about?
No, I thought I heard, was that Christine's voice?
Well, I just was thanking George for the write-up on Barnes & Noble. That's very sweet. You know, when somebody reads your book and then writes a review, that's like, you know, you get a star next to your name in heaven for that kind of activity. Carlene, she's wrong. Carlene saying, that's right. And Carlene's got lots of reviews. I just did a little search. She's up in the hundreds on her reviews, so good, well done there.
Well, let me ask you this question. I have a question here about writing a book as technical as aviation disasters and research that you guys do. Do you have a limited audience there that would pick up and read a book like this? Would it be, I don't know, what's your thoughts about the folks that you're trying to get to read your book? I guess that's what I'm trying to say. And you spend so much time in writing these books. And, George, you, too, are writing a book about Eastern Airlines. I mean, Eastern Airlines folded its wings 20-plus years ago, and yet I guess people still find it interesting.
You know, I think the Internet has enabled a lot of I didn't mean to just jump in there, George, but I think that, tell me if you agree, I think the Internet's enabled a lot of people to connect into their little, you know, whatever their niche of interest is. So my first book came out in 2000, and, you know, the Internet was around, of course, but we didn't use it the way we do now with social media. And so, you know, people, I think, knew about my book. It was much more widely reviewed, but still it got to the general public. And of the general public, I think it's a small percentage who are interested in air disaster books. But now my book has come out, you know, in the era of social media and, you know, and the ability to reach out to people. And my book has been much, much, much more successful in a much shorter period of time because I go directly to those people who I know have an interest in either aviation or aviation safety or mysteries and that sort of thing. So I think it, you know, it's sort of the yin and the yang of it is that you can, you know, it is a smaller group that's interested. This isn't a beach book, but yet, you know, I can find all the people. It's much easier to find the people who are interested in this subject. You know, I'd rather talk to your show than, you know, Howard Stern, because your show is going to be people who are more likely to go out and buy this book because this is their subject.
Yeah.
You see? So that's, you know, that's the upside of it. I mean, do you find that to be the case, George?
Yes, I do. And of course, my book was very, very, was impacted a lot by Dan Futrell and Isaac Stoner and Peter Frick Wright, who went down to La Paz just last May and, you know, went up to the Flight 980 crash site. And then Peter Frick Wright wrote a lengthy article in Outside Magazine, which really generated a lot of interest and a lot of sales of the book.
Right.
And rightfully so. And I believe Peter called me up a couple of weeks ago. I believe they're going to do a follow-up in Outside Magazine also on their trip. So that certainly helped a lot. And
look,
you know,
that expanded your market because it's not just aviation people. It's the adventure seekers and it's the outdoors people who might not otherwise have thought they'd be interested in your book. So that sort of expands you into a different niche, which is great.
It is.
And
Carlene,
how about you and your books, and what's your thoughts about this?
Well, you know, I being that I have just the fiction novels, oh, my gosh, it's snowing in Seattle right now. I'm sorry. I just looked out the window. We're having a snowstorm in Seattle, which is very unusual for this time of year. No, you know what? I've noticed that people do come through my table, and they say there's a lot of people looking for nonfiction. They want your books. There's these aviation conferences that it's kind of difficult to go to if it's not in your hometown because you got to pack all your books and go and sit there all day and talk to people, but it's so much fun. But there are a ton of people out there. Everyone comes in. They want to know what's going on. There's aviation buffs. Alaska Airlines, or not Alaska, they're having one up in Alaska that gets 50,000 people coming through, and it's the first weekend of May. But what happened with mine is I created this first novel, and then I created the second novel, and then I started the PhD, so I thought, I kind of shifted hats a little bit, and I thought, okay, this will be the time to get the easier book out, the motivation book, and so I can have something at the conference next year. And everyone came through, and they were mad at me because they wanted a Darby book. And they said, where's Darby? And it was so funny because I didn't realize that they had fallen in love with one of the characters. And then so then I kind of got in trouble. So now I promised everyone Darby will be back, you know. So now I have to do a Darby book every year. But it's been fun writing. And I'm trying to convert those technical readers over to realize that in fiction, there's a lot of truth in fiction. And now that I see, you know, I'll read a book. One of my favorite authors is Robert Dagoni, and he's an attorney, and so he writes law, you know, with a law theme to it. And I'll read something and go, wow, that's fascinating. I go look it up, and it's true. And so I think that, you know, there's such a nice balance between the both. But for you authors to be able to take nonfiction and create something that's entertaining and reads well is such a talented art. You know, I hope to be able to get that way because at the end of mine, I want to write one of those books on the truth and the essence of what's going on, you know, the truth behind my series. So, but it is an art. It's a skill. Sometimes I feel like a little bit of a cheat because I get plot points thrown at me and I just have to work them in and develop my characters and you know, work it that way. But, yeah, it's fun. For any author, you know you put a lot of work into it, but it's such a passion. It's almost a release, you know, and thank you, you know, for your compliments on what I do, but it's kind of like I have more fun creating my little world and my novels than I do watching TV. So, you know, my husband's out watching the sports, and I'm in here working on my book. So, yeah, so it's, you know, it's really nice when your work is passion, kind of like flying. It's like the first time I got an airplane, they're going to pay me to do this, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, my favorite author, I like American history, or history period. And Herman Walk takes the actual events in American history and war, especially World War II, and he turned it and created, you know, those the Winds of War series. I think there were two books that he did. And what do you call that? It's fictional characters with
historical fiction.
Historical fiction. That's it. Well, I'm glad you guys are there. I'm still trying to figure out a little bio about myself. But at any rate, it's great that you create a book of interest and people can move right along in the book. I'm sure they have questions. Is this actual? Is this factual? Did this happen? And I want to ask this question. That's my little blurb there. But I want to ask this question. When an aircraft accident happens, a disaster happens, what do you do, Christine, especially you, because you're news reporting, you're right live on national media coverage, and how do you get involved in this type of investigation?
Well, in my case, you know, I've done investigations from two different perspectives, both as a journalist. I covered the crash of TWA Flight 800 for CNN, and then for ABC, I covered the disappearance of Malaysia Flight 370. So that's basically a public investigation. I'm working with the material in front of me that, you know, that's coming out with the daily briefing and whatever information I can, you know, scare up from, you know, from my contacts and, you know, information facts that come out. And I'll give you a quick example of that. You may remember that about 6 weeks ago, there was an airplane flying from Bolivia to Colombia. It had a Brazilian soccer team on it. And the plane ran out of fuel on landing at Medellin, just short of the runway in Medellin. So I read about that. I woke up to it and heard it on the news and started looking around on the Internet. So I'm sitting in my pajamas in Old Greenwich, Connecticut, just sort of looking around on the Internet. Now, remember when it first happened, nobody knew why the plane landed. That he reported to air traffic control that he had a power loss, a total power failure. But I looked at the route map just basically from FlightAware, and then I looked at the model aircraft, and then I thought, this doesn't seem like a plane that could go that far. That's a 4.5-hour flight. So I was just Googling the specs on the aircraft. And by, you know, an hour later, I'd written a blog post saying, looks to me like this plane might have run out of fuel. It's beyond the range of this aircraft. So, you know, of course, we know 2 days later that's exactly what happened. But I am not telling you this by way of saying, aren't I clever? What I'm saying is there's an awful lot of information out there, and all you have to do is put one and one and one together, and you can figure out, in some cases, what should be the next step in the investigation. I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm saying that you can sort of see the direction things are going in. So that's the way you do it, you know, from the public, from the outsider's perspective. Then I also worked as an air crash investigator for Kreindler and Kreindler, which is the law firm that George, in fact, I think that's how I met you, George, is through Kreindler and Kreindler. But that,
yes,
they, you know, they represent families who have lost someone in an air accident, and their investigations, you know, basically look and see, well, what's the NTSB or whoever the investigative body, what are they doing, and are there things that they're not looking at that they should look at? And so in that respect, I go out and I hire experts, and I have them go over the public evidence and some of the information that's available to the family. And we, you know, sort of ask questions. We do our own investigation. Those are both very different from what the NTSB does, obviously, because the NTSB has hands-on access to everything. But, you know, that's the sort of the sweeping answer to your question.
Do you have any problems getting information from the NTSB? Just when do you jump in there and start to contacting them and asking for more questions to be answered?
Oh, sometimes they're very difficult to deal with, but I'd say lately that hasn't been the case. During TWA Flight 800, which was 1996, so you got to cut them some slack, it was a while ago, during that time, there were the press department was very sort of clicky, you know. They had the reporters they wanted to talk to, and other people were sort of frozen out. So they can be very difficult. Now, over the years, they've gotten very savvy, and they're terrific in the way they deal with the public now because they use social media. So everybody on Twitter can see the latest thing that the NTSB is releasing. Now, they've taken some heat from that, too, from during Asiana 214. They took some heat because the chairman, Deb Hirschman, was tweeting some information that she got, which she is entitled to do as the public representative of the air safety investigators. But ALPA said that it was the first time they were using Twitter this way, and ALPA was arguing that they were releasing information that prejudged the investigation. In fact, they were not, but they were not used to seeing the NTSB distribute information in that way, and I think it alarmed them. But the other thing I will say is when I worked at Kreindler and Kreindler, I remember we had a case in which we wanted to take a look at a propeller. We wanted to have it examined. And the NTSB damned if they hadn't lost it. And we never did get that propeller. So sometimes, yes, you know, they do stuff that like any other person screws up on a job. They, you know, they didn't do a very good thing, and they lost this, what was for us, a critical piece of evidence.
And George knows that very well, don't you, George?
I sure do, Neil.
Well, I've been hogging all the questions here. Any of our hosts and our listeners, because our board is completely lit up tonight.
I have a question.
Go ahead, Chuck.
I investigated on the Internet two crashes. One was recently, and one was back in 99. Korean Air cargo flight 8509 crashed on takeoff, mainly because one of the instruments, the INU, failed, and they said that they had repaired it on the ground, but unfortunately it did not respond as they were taking off on the captain's side, but the co-pilot side was functioning, so they felt that it was going to make it. One of the things that I ran into with these two investigations, and I guess it's because they're Asian Airlines, maybe I'm wrong, but what happened here is the captain, he kept banking the airplane to the left, and it didn't show up that he was doing this incorrect, and for some reason, the co-pilot didn't say anything until it got to where the flight engineer called out the word bank, which was supposed to alert the crew that you're having a problem here. And there was no response from the captain, and he continued banking the airplane, and he kept going to the left, which is obviously the plane has so many feet of wing, and finally the wing just dug into the ground, and the aircraft just came apart at about 300 knots. And of course, unfortunately, nobody survived. And after this investigation, United Kingdom Air Accident Investigation Branch issued a recommendation to Korean Air to revise its training program and company culture to promote a more free atmosphere between the captain and the first officer. Since then, Korean Air has not had a single fatality crash since this accident and one in 1999. Now, I would like to get your opinion. Have you in your investigation, both of you actually, found this to be true in the Asian culture?
Well, I'll jump in with that. Absolutely, it's the case. And as I recall that accident, there was a real imbalance. I mean, the captain was highly, highly experienced, and the first officer was, you know, had just out of qualifying on the flight. The details aren't clear with me, but I do remember there was a real experience imbalance in the crew there. But even Yeah, notwithstanding that, though, that, you know, this whole, I'm on sort of a campaign about this because the whole notion of crew resource management, of course, is that, you know, you remove the imbalance and everyone has the opportunity to speak up. But what's being discovered now, we're 40 years into CRM, 30 or 40 years into CRM, and we still see accidents like this happening right down in the accident I just talked about in Latin America. The first officer didn't speak up when he saw that the captain was departing on a flight where they didn't even have enough fuel to make it. And Asiana 214, where the captain did not do a go-around, even though he was on an unstabilized approach and should have done a go-around, and the training captain did not correct him. We see these events continuing to happen. And my feeling is, at this point, I think that the aviation community needs to relook at whether you can tell cultures to throw these cultural restrictions aside and do it like the Westerners, because to some respect, it's unrealistic. A Japanese culture, you know, that where you do not speak back to someone who is your senior, but I'm going to get into this seat in this cockpit and I'm going to forget that, hasn't worked. And we can bang our heads against the wall about that for another 40 years, or we can maybe try a different approach. If it works in Western culture, great, and appears to be. But in other countries, in other cultures, Latin American culture, Middle Eastern culture, Asian culture, not so much.
One of the other questions I had in mind, and our little group has talked this over for years, and consequently, it's based on the idea that we're now coming out with autonomous cars, and eventually, since we have so much autopilot systems and the airplane, eventually, are they going to take the pilot out of the cockpit?
They are definitely going for that route and heading that way. And I think the only thing that's holding them back right now is security. They have not mastered the security. But what I see happening is this induced pilot shortage. I mean, we're growing airlines or buying airplanes like crazy. We are having a lot of retirement on the top end, and we can't get pilots into this. And what do? We create this 1,500-hour rule. So I think what's going to happen, and I'm going to try and keep that, I'm going to try and be an advocate to stop it, but I can see we're going to get to a point where technology is going to get good enough, and they're going to say, okay, the four-person augmented crew, technology is so good, we're having a pilot shortage, so we have to, economics is most important, we're going to go down to three pilots, and the three crew are going to go down to two pilots, the two crew are eventually going to go to one. And I never realized how close and where they were headed with that until I got into the research and started seeing what was going on. And I had a discussion with an engineer who came out, and he said, we don't even need you anymore. He says, it won't be long. And I said, yeah, I know something that I can do that your autopilot can't do. And I said, I can land a 20-knot crosswind. And he laughed, and he looked, and he says, but we're going to fix that. So, right now we can land a little bit further parameters in automation, but they're working on it, and it's not unrealistic. It's not going to be one of those futuristic things. It's going to be very, it's going to be reality. But go ahead.
No, finish.
I was just saying, alignment with that about pilots not speaking up is because our training is getting cut so short. I don't think that our pilots really have an in-depth understanding of the aircraft. We're teaching ourselves at home on a flash drive. We don't go to ground school anymore. We don't have a group of people that we can discuss with if we don't understand something. And we may misinterpret it on our own, and then that's our first learned, and that's what we think. And so we're kind of doing this on our own. So when the systems break or something's wrong, I think a lot in the Western culture, we're going to be seeing pilots sitting there and not speaking out because they don't really understand or know what's going on. And if the captain with that experience is letting us go, it must be okay. And I can really see that we're going to be going down that path, not too long in the future.
When you said that, Carlene, the person you were talking to said, the guy who was promoting automated flight said to you, well, you said, I can land in a 20-knot crosswind, and he said, well, we'll fix that. I thought, yeah, he's talking to you. You're not going to fix that in the airplane. He's going to make sure that you can't land in a 20-knot crosswind. You know why? Because the more you rely on automation, the flabbier your skills get. That is already proven. And so, this business about the first officer's not exactly sure whether the captain's doing the right thing or not because his flying skills are flabby, and he doesn't recognize that the captain's flying skills are flabby. And that's absolutely already happening. It's already happening. So here's the thing. So that convinces the folks who want to automate aircraft even more. Let's continue to make pilots who have deteriorating skills. Let's continue to do the thing that's making them unable to be on their, ahead of their aircraft all the time. It's a death spiral. It's essentially a death spiral.
Did you read Flight for Sanity already?
I did not read you. Carlene, I haven't read any of your books, but now I've just ordered three of them.
I'm absolutely joking because that's kind of the setup that I'm looking at. Why are we creating this world? It's almost like we're intentionally creating this world of skill deficit pilots. We know what's happening, and we know it, and everybody knows it, but they're not asking why, and they're not doing anything about it. Yeah. And because I think that they're going to just say, okay, we're just going to create these pilots are going to crash. It's human error, but look at our automation. And you get a public perception that as long as you have automation, there's not going to be human error. Well, I'm sorry. If somebody's on the ground with an automated aircraft in the sky, they're going to have human error. It just is what it is.
It's a different kind of human error because those computers don't spring from the head of Zeus. They are designed by humans. And the same error-prone humans that fly airplanes create software and create the interface and create the machine-computer interface. So the same, there's the same fallible human, only this time they're programming the airplane.
I'm going to put Dorothy in there. She's trying to get a question in.
I'm sorry,
Dorothy. That's okay. The thing that I was going to say is being a computer person, I know how computers crash all the time. I can't imagine a plane being up and not having somebody there. The what if case it does, because everyone knows it does happen. And that's what the problem is. They're going to put all of these non-piloted planes up there and say, well, they're all computerized, but there's every computer that up and started out, it always has coordinates that aren't quite right, things that won't work. So they make it a little better, and they'll send you an update, and they'll fix it a little bit more and fix it a little bit more. You buy any kind of a program, you know how long it takes for that program to be absolutely secure. It's not, because there's always something that needs more tweaking that they haven't done. Well, you put that in a plane, you're up in the air, what do you do then if there's nobody around to take care of it and get it down?
What about a hacker?
Correct.
I believe.
And then there's cyber threats, correct?
Well, I think the one factor that's being overlooked here completely is the bottom line factor. That's why they're doing all of this, is to enhance the bottom line, to do away with a lot of the labor problems that are currently out there with pilots. But I believe that it's all in order to earn more dollars. I mean, there's no other reason. There's no good reason for it other than that. If you think about it, that the bottom line is the bottom line.
Just to interject something, George, one of the things that's causing the pilot shortage, which I read this article was, because I keep up with my military career that I had, is that the pilots in the services now are not coming out and joining the airlines because the military realized that these guys were quitting the military and going and getting higher paid jobs. So now the government has issued, starting about almost 7 or 8 years ago, to start giving these pilots, these very experienced pilots, higher salaries to keep them in, and bonuses. And that's contributing somewhat to the pilot shortage that you guys see now. You're not getting military pilots as much as you used to.
Well, that's what I said.
Yeah, and I think the military pilots, there's not many going to the military as they were, because if they want to fly, you're not necessarily guaranteed a flight slot any longer. Your flight slot could be operating a drone. And so 50% of those flight pilots going into the military may not even ever see the inside of an airplane.
Yeah, a lot of the drone pilots are not even officers. They're non-coms.
Right.
And they're halfway around the world. But they know how to run video games. They've been doing it all their lives. And that's what they
are. Yeah, I'm just saying, you know, it's like, you know, this is going to be the next level of terrorism, and you can plan. This will be like novel 7. It's two novels out. But you know, as long as we can keep the terrorists off the aircraft, and I keep them out and close that door and keep them off my airplane, for all intents and purposes, is going to be safe flying. But could you imagine 100,000, you know, thousands of airplanes in the sky, and they're all being operated on the ground in a big warehouse? All it takes is one person to open that door, and the entire sky, an entire industry gets taken out, you know, every airplane in one swoop. And
but they may not even need to enter that door, Carlene. They can hack
exactly.
in there. And
right.
so, and,
exactly.
and that really is the fly-by-wire threat truly is a cyber threat, more than pilot complacency, because that's, you know, that you can sort of, that's a human by human, but the cyber threat, it's already there. They're already able to do these things. So, and I think that they're way behind. I mean, the aviation industry is way behind in keeping up with that.
You know,
it was like tri-rail.
Tri-rail. Go ahead, Don.
It sounds like tri-rail is going to be the way to go.
I don't know. There's been an awful lot of railroad accidents lately.
Well,
I don't know.
Wow, what an eye opener!
You know what? I'd love to give a little blurb for John Nance's new book, Lockout. It's actually an A330 that is addressing exactly what we're talking about. It's just somebody put something on the airplane to take control over it. He did a very good job of it, and it kind of will open your eyes to what the potential is for one aircraft. You know,
it
on all of them. Yeah,
he's great.
They made a movie about
really
that when they drove the president's airplane by fly-by-wire. Some terrorist group took over the airplane. So not too far behind, I guess.
Yep.
Yeah. Well,
it's the same guy that landed on the taxiway.
Harrison Ford, right.
Was he in
Ford.
A high? Oh, wow.
Harrison.
Yeah.
And I think
poor Harrison. But I think if Harrison looks around a little bit, he's going to find that there's been three major airlines who have done the same thing.
Pilots actually landed
on the taxiway, and they're still working. So
yeah.
They're still
really,
flying.
That's still happening?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Landing on the wrong runway or a wrong airport?
Absolutely. He just did
or
it
on the taxiway.
Yep.
Wow.
I remember that happening down in Miami. Instead of landing on Miami International, they landed at a smaller airport up north that the Navy had. It was a Navy a base that had folded up, but they still used it for small aircraft, but they still had long runway.
Well, I'm old enough now that I'm old enough and retired that I can tell my experience. The first officer saved me. I would have landed at Davis-Monthan instead of that the one down south of it.
Tucson?
Yeah, Tucson. I couldn't even see how old I am. I can't even think now. But, yeah, I was lined up beautifully, and I thought I had the right profile all the way down to landing at Davis-Monthan or to Tucson. Instead, I was lined up for Davis-Monthan. And as
so good CRM in that cockpit, obviously.
Yeah.
If your first officer spoke up, good for him.
Exactly, yeah. And I don't know what resulted out of that, but, Carlene, you mentioned SMS. That's a new acronym or letters. So what do you talk about SMS? Or maybe,
SMS is simplest version. It's Safety Management Systems, and they've been doing this over in Europe for years. Kudos for Alaska Airlines because they were trying to implement this probably 10, 15 years ago, and the FAA couldn't even help them do it. And now it's going to be mandated. It's actually, there's a mandate out January 2018. So we're now within a year of a mandate, and still, you know, we're still at the square one at this. But SMS envision crew resource management for the corporation. And what we're trying to do with it is to tear down this hierarchy of structures and these silos where, you know, it's a chain of command, you got to go into the bottom and, they shut you down right there. And open up and make it a flatter organization where every employee is able to come forward. And the components they have, like safety policy, it's about safety policy, it's about safety assurance, safety risk management, and under safety assurance, making sure that people, they have a good reporting culture. Safety culture is huge under this. You need to have a reporting culture, a flexible culture, a learn culture, adjust. And you really need to, it's just like if you had your flight deck where we want everyone's information to come together because we're going to make better decisions that way. And if somebody sees something wrong, we can do it. And you know what? We're not there yet. I'm looking at some of these airlines, and they do not have a safety culture. This is a huge, huge theme in my book, Flight for Sanity, because as we spoke last time, you can't fire pilots for reporting safety or making too many ASRs or, that's bad. But you can pull them for other things. And they're utilizing German wings as a tactic to do this. And it's just if you have an airline that does that because somebody has reported safety, you don't have a safety culture to support SMS. And SMS is going to be a really good thing. I was looking through all those accidents and trying to see what areas could we have applied SMS processes to that. And almost everywhere. You know, look at who was it? Was it TWA that lost the A330 that lost the – or the A300 that lost its tail because they slammed on the rudder? Remember out in New York?
No, that was American.
That's right. American Airlines. So they slammed on the rudder. Well, what they found out after that investigation, like 2-3 years later, that they had an instructor who said, no, you can't. They were teaching it in the sim. The pilot who did this, the captain the trip before, had told him, no, you can't be doing it. He says, no, this is what they're teaching us in the simulator. A Czech airman in the simulator said, this can't be right. So he wrote to his chief pilot, and he wrote to Boeing. Granted, wasn't in a Boeing aircraft, but he had a connection there, and they wrote a letter back. So all this documentation came out like 5 years after this horrific accident that if SMS had been in place and they really truly had true communication, risk mitigation processes in place to address these things when they came forward, that never would have happened. And you know, that's what SMS is all about. It's just to mitigate the risk and make sure it doesn't happen. And I am just sighing that it's, you know, I have this huge sigh and huge disappointment because it's just not good. Our airlines aren't there with the safety culture to support this right now.
Well, we've got a little extra noise
SMS
here.
SMS is another Six Sigma in the air.
Yeah.
We've got so many numbers here on my board. I'm only allowed 25 on my board that I can see, but others are listening, I'm sure. And if any of our listeners would like to ask Christine, Carlene, or George any questions, please do so. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, hi. Am I on?
Yes, you're on.
Yeah, this is Jim Wright. I'm a friend of Carlene's, and we've been doing kind of a novel experiment combining aviation with the maritime industry. And the question I was going to ask Carlene is whether you notice in the airline industry a decrease in the number of guys that are competent at hand flying, which would be kind of similar to unassisted ship handling in our business. Because as these guys disappear from the scene, then the likelihood of having realistic training in that area starts going along with them.
Great question.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they came out, the Office Inspector General came out in 2015 or 16 and said, they came out and said, pilots lack flying skills. And it's true. And I had asked a Czech airman once, why aren't the pilots hand flying these aircraft? And he said, because they lack confidence, they're afraid, and they're afraid they lack confidence, and they just don't have the skill to do it. The lack of understanding is what he said. And wow. And actually, this is what I'm working on in my research to try and find out. We know this problem exists, that pilots don't have the skill, but, you know, you think, oh, just disengage automation, like on the Airbus, you disengage the autopilot. It's not like a normal airplane that used to fly over at Eastern. It's still, there's computers working behind the scenes. And so It's a lot easier to push the button, you know. And I share a story. A Czech airman told a captain who was asking too many questions, stop asking questions if you want to get through this program. Be the monkey, push the button, and get the banana. And that's how they're training. So, so it is a problem, yeah.
Well, that's all we have time for today, folks. And we hope you enjoyed this rebroadcast of episode 307. And we heard the ladies and gentlemen that are authors of books and active in air investigations. What a show that was. And if you would like to listen to the entirety of that show, go to blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie, abbreviated Captain, CAPTEDDIE, Captain Eddie. We hope you enjoyed today's broadcast from the Eastern Files, as we normally call it this time of day. And if you'd like to contribute a story from your own Eastern days and in your own voice or to be read on the broadcast, please give us an email. And we will show you how simple it is to tell your story on From the Eastern Files. Just send them to host@EALRadioshow.com. host@EALRadioshow.com. We want you to be part of the radio show. And until next week and another broadcast from the Eastern Files, we say so long, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern.